I'm Christopher Lydon for Open Source. Listen fast, podcast people, because the beloved artist, satirist, global muckraker, Molly Crabapple, talks fast. Same way she draws and paints a sort of carnival of conflict out there in Syria, in her father's storm-damaged Puerto Rico, in New York City. Molly Crabapple was a naked model and a cafe cabaret sort of ornament in Lower Manhattan before Occupy landed on her doorstep in 2011. In the turmoil, she invented a new career that's made her famous, illustrating rough places in the real world. With her color tubes and razor-sharp pen nibs, Molly finds the trouble and sends back handmade images for a visual culture that is overdosed on video. Her new book with the writer Marwan Hisham is called Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. We see you, Molly Crabapple, as this kind of intrepid woman from New York with her paints and brushes and pens leading the way. You're a light out there for trouble, but for stories we need to know. How do you describe yourself? How do you look to yourself?
I just draw and write. I'm a very curious person. I'm a big nerd. And I like to see history as it happens. And so I always use my sketchbook like a lockpick to get myself into places I wasn't supposed to. And I suppose that I like art because it makes me see truly and it lets me move. Hmm. And I like writing because then I get to think about where I went later. I'm just someone with my words and my pictures, I guess.
I think of Syria in your drawings and as well as Marwan's reports from Raqqa. But that's the way I think we're going to remember it. This spattered chaos in infinite detail, but alive, baroque, weird, and miserable, bloody. We get it and believe it somehow in your drawings as we never could figure it out in the papers or on television. Molly, give us your own retrospective on Syria. Brothers of the Gun.
Me and one of my best friends in the world, Marwan Hisham, we spent the last 3 years working on a book about Syria, especially about Marwan's memories of the revolution, the war, the ISIS occupation of his hometown, Raqqa, and Marwan's beliefs in the power of journalism. It's something we co-wrote as equals, and also Marwan art directed me so much that, in my opinion, there's not a single line in that book, either text or visual, that's not both of ours. Mm. The story that Marwan tells is of a country that was profoundly betrayed by absolutely everyone. And Raqqa, the city that he's from, that he last saw in 2016, has been 90% destroyed by the Americans. The Americans, they lie and say that 21 people were killed, 21 people in the four-month campaign to rout ISIS. Amnesty says it's at least 1,400. It's probably more. It's hard to even say. The city is filled with crushed buildings that have rotten corpses in them. Meanwhile, the northern Syrian city of Afrin, which was predominantly Kurdish, was invaded by Turkey and its proxies and is now sort of a mix of ultra-criminal police state and looting free-for-all of idiocy. I mean, 1.5 million people are on regime wanted lists. Most of those people can never go back to Syria. Mm. It's a country that's essentially been divided up into three spheres of influence that perhaps will never be made into one country again. The Syrian regime, the American sphere, which is east of the Euphrates, and the Turkish occupied part, and also Idlib, which is still nominally independent and held by rebel groups, including Al-Qaeda. It's a country that at the time the UN stopped counting, 500,000 people had been killed in the war, and that was years ago they stopped counting, where half of it, all people are displaced, where millions were driven out to become refugees in countries that are increasingly less welcoming and tolerant to them and increasingly want to force them out. And, you know, this all came from a popular revolution that was put down in the most brutal way possible by a government that said in its graffiti that its supporters would put up Assad or we burn the country, and they did burn the country.
I just marvel that we still don't have the foggiest idea in print logical terms, reporting terms almost, why it happened, how it happened. I feel terribly guilty about Syria, but I only feel I grasp the mood of it when I look at your pictures.
my initial collaborations with Marwan, they were from photos that he took under ISIS occupation. You know, he risked getting beheaded to take these photos. But for the book, we wanted to do drawings of Syria that were of stuff that he didn't have photos of. Things from his deep past, things from protests where they were shooting live ammo at people, things of enslaved Yazidi women who were brought into his cafe. And for those, he called the process like downloading his memories, right? I would interview him over and over, and I would do sketches, and he would tell me I was wrong, and I would do more sketches, and I would say, what do you mean when you say that our hands are careless? And he'd say, like this, and we would do it over and over and over. And also, I would do drawings, like the big panoramic crowd scenes. For stuff like that, I would take citizen video that was just like showing blurry snippets of the crowd because it was video done by people who were running. I would freeze frame that video over and over and over and over again until I got like a proper panorama, right? I'd print out all those freeze frames. I'd lay them all out. I would repose models because very often when it was printed, like they just looked like smudges. And with that, I would try to reconstruct what it would have actually felt like, right? If you were there, if you were looking at it.
We believe you're a witness in a world of sort of collapsing media and understanding. We believe the girl from New York who's there with pen and ink and paint. You've dueled with Nick Kristof of the New York Times on the plight of sex workers, too, for example. Yeah. And I believe your account more than his. Why?
I don't know, because I know what I'm talking about. And Nick Kristof rides around in the back of cop cars and, you know, fell for a notorious fraud in Cambodia named Somali Mom, who lied about her entire past because Nick Kristof wants an easy story. That's why. And so when you want an easy story, that's what makes you gullible.
Take me to the misery, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. Show me the adorable girl that was beaten by a pimp, but now has been rescued and is going to learn how to be a hairdresser. You know, he wants a simple story like that.
How do you make it different?
I get to know people. I did a piece on prostitution courts in New York, which were pitching themselves as an alternative to criminalization of sex work. But in actuality, they totally weren't, because the women were still getting arrested by the same police that raped them and steal their money, still being, you know, put in the same miserable jails. But then when they were taken to court, instead of them being sentenced to jail, they would sentence them kind of to counseling, which, by the way, does nothing if you're trafficked either. Like, if you were actually trafficked, you need a place to stay that's safe. You don't just need to go to a self-esteem building class. And I spent a lot of time at those courts, and I just hung out and I talked to women. I found a woman who had been, had been a sex worker, but one of the things that happens is if you're a sex worker in New York and, you know, you're someone the cops know, right? They just arrest you whenever you go outside. Like, you could just be going outside to go to the bodega to get some smokes and the cops will arrest you. And that was what had happened to her. The cops saw her, she was outside, and they arrested her. And she sued them for a false arrest, and she won. And she was someone who had been a sex worker. She told me in an interview that she had stopped. She was getting her x-ray tech degree. And she told me that was at her graduation ceremony, she wanted to like lift up her gown and show her garter belt because that's how she paid for school. And she was like a lady in her 40s. You know, she was like a mom. She like, you know, worked as like street-based worker. She wasn't, you know, some fancy lady. But she was totally like tough and cynical and sarcastic and resilient in a way that those women aren't typically allowed to be in Nick Kristof's accounts or in other accounts like that.
Molly, I see your work and I see lots of other people doing something like it, including students and amateur artists painting buildings and bridges in Lynn, Massachusetts, the old shoe city. Really spectacular murals that everybody is loving. But of course, our mutual friend Genzir in Cairo made himself famous the world around with those paintings in Tahrir Square. It's an old, old, old tradition seeming to have new life in all sorts of ways. Joe Sacco, for example, subway art. You always go back to Picasso and Guernica. Why is it flourishing today? Is it because other ways of telling stories just don't, there's something missing?
Well, with murals, I think it's actually something specific. I'm sure that I'll piss off a lot of fans of contemporary architecture here, but I feel like we've forgotten how to build beautiful cities. We don't want to build beautiful cities. Maybe we think it's too expensive. And so, especially in America, we're living very often in cities of profound ugliness and plainness, and murals are a way to make them human and beautiful again, right? They're a way to reclaim all of that and to
decorative,
wrap it.
Yeah, expressive.
Yeah, decorative, expressive, very often challenging, right? And especially unsanctioned street art. Like when I was in Santurce in Puerto Rico, they have some of the best street art in the world, right? And it just sprawls over everything. And it's so gorgeous and sometimes really harsh also. Some of it's little, sometimes it's big, but it takes the city and it makes it human scale again. It's how you seize the walls again.
Didn't know about this. Go on.
For me, that was quite personal. My father's Puerto Rican. My father's from San Sebastian. So in Santurce, which is kind of like the artist's neighborhood, but also like a lot of Puerto Rican neighborhoods, it's also like pretty abandoned in large swaths.
We're talking post-hurricanes.
Post-hurricanes, yeah. But even pre-hurricanes because of the economic disaster. A lot of Puerto Ricans, they had to leave Puerto Rico to work on the mainland because, you know, there aren't a lot of jobs. And so Santurce is just covered with the most gorgeous street art in the world. My God. Like I would just like pictures of like Taínos and political prisoners and just kids and satires of events and indescribable, beautiful things. This mixture of like, you know, deep Puerto Rican traditional heritage stuff with AK-47s and starbursts and drag queens everywhere, crawling over every surface. Rio Piedras, the student neighborhood, is like this too. Astoundingly, astoundingly talented people. And it's a way of saying, like, maybe it's just a concrete overpass near me, but these walls are mine. This city's mine, you know? It's not just, you know, in Santurce. I mean, I think about the walls of Athens, right? I think about really talented artists in Beirut. Yeah, it's reclaiming the city, right? It's reclaiming
Absolutely.
The city. It's saying, like, no, capital, you can't just take this all from us. It's ours, too.
Yeah, I think of Egypt, Alexandria and Cairo. 3-4 years ago, unbelievable explosion of energy, confidence, people repainting that whole square, Tahrir Square, overnight, virtually every night, with new scenes, basically cartoons of the day's news, horror stories, police beatings, victims, or survivors.
One of the critiques that the Communist Party always had of Frida Kahlo, or the type of art Frida Kahlo did, was that easel painting is inherently bourgeois, right? Because only one person can have painting at a time, whereas mural paintings like what Siqueiras and Rivera did was supposed to be proletarian because everyone could, you know, see it. And obviously, in the age where people are looking at things online, Frida's work is more mass accessible than Diego's, which you actually have to see. But I think that what Tahrir Square was doing was they were living up to that promise of murals. Like, here's a way to talk to everyone in the streets where they are, even if they can't read, right? They can see the day's news there.
Mm. I met Ganzir, so to speak. He had left Cairo, but in a gallery, there was a painting that's being packed up to at the end of an exhibition of a cat, one of the oldest symbols in Egyptian culture, going way back before the pharaohs, but so wily, so strong, so immediately energizing. It was on a door-sized board. I couldn't get it onto a plane. I wanted desperately to buy it. What is it that's so electric, galvanizing, clear about that sort of popular expression, blossoming of talent in the street?
Because it's done with our hands and our minds, and also because it's not allowed. That is the big thing. Mm. It is not allowed. It is something that we risk arrest to do. You're not getting permission from, you're not getting a grant for, you're not applying to do it, you're not asking anyone's permission, you're just going out into the street and you're doing it, and anyone can see it. And they might hate it, they might like it, but they're going to see it.
We follow your eye and your heart. I always want to know, where is Molly? Where are you going? What are you finding interesting? Where's the challenge? What next?
I'm just reading a lot. Like, I'm burnt out. This book was really, really hard to do. I mean, Marwan, in a lot of parts, when we were writing this book together, he was in Raqqa, and he's one of my best friends on earth, and I thought he was going to get killed all the time. And it's hard, you know, to like do something with someone who you think that the next time you see them, they're going to be in an execution video. Then also, it's just hard to write a book with someone else because writers are egoists. And when you have like two egoists together, it's all like, don't you kill my darling or I'm going to kill your darling. Your darling is hostage now.
And kill your own darling.
Yes, yes, exactly. So it was hard, right? And on so many levels, even though it's probably the most precious thing I've ever done in my life, doing that sort of collaboration that's so intimate is really hard too. So in terms of what I'm doing now, I mean, What am I doing now? I'm going to Indonesia to collaborate with some Indonesian feminist artists. But in terms of like a big thing, I want to write a book about like cosmopolitanism and how ethno-nationalists try to destroy it. I like places where people from a lot of places where they live together and where they get to keep themselves and where no one is trying to displace them or tear them from their homes or tear them from each other, and where there can be amazing new collaborations and solidarities. Sometimes that word, it gets like kind of an elitist taint, which I think is very unfair, but I realize it has that connotation. But for me, it's the cosmopolitanism of a street vendors meeting in New York, where you had people from the Sudan and Jamaica and Baghdad and Beijing that were all together, and they were all these like immigrant hustlers, and they were all fighting a certain power structure that had them down. It was cosmopolitanism where, yeah, like a lady from Beijing that was managing all the portrait artists would like come break her fast with a guy that was selling kebab, you know, from Port Said.
What are your favorite sights abroad?
My favorite sights abroad. I'm an Istanbul girl forever and ever. I know the country has long since sunk into authoritarianism. I know plenty of people who have been jailed or banned from the country. And yet never, never, never can I go into that city without my heart filling. So I don't know. I've dedicated the book in part to the street cats of Cihangir. Maybe they're the ultimate cosmopolitans. Are the street cats, are they Greek? Are they Turkish? Where are those street cats from? Have they been there forever? Are they Romans, Byzantines? But they sit on everyone's lap and steal everyone's food and bite everyone's ankles all the same.
Look for the cats first.
When I think of cosmopolitanism that's contemporary and that's hopeful, I think of the squats in Athens, where you have people from all sorts of places, Iran, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Syria, living alongside Greeks, a lot of Spanish volunteers, and living together and creating their own culture together. I think about this graffiti I saw on the wall. It was in Greek, Arabic, and English, and it said, "Greeks and foreigners, we live together, we work together, and we fight the Nazis together."
Molly Crabapple, it's such a privilege to read you, to study you, to gab with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.